Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. First, I wanted to give you a little notice about a little concert happening tomorrow. It's called Sounds Green. It's part of Cambridge Summer Music Festival, and it's being held at the Botanical Gardens in Cambridge at 6:15. And the group is called Bella Tromba, and it's a girls' band, they call themselves, and it's all trumpets, a lot of innovative things. And it will be a beautiful evening. You sit on the ground, listen to the music, and bring your own food and your drinks and have a picnic and enjoy yourself. 6:15 to 7:30 p.m. There's admissions to the garden, but the concert itself is free. There's a basket being passed around for your donations, and that will be that. So that's part of Cambridge Summer Music Festival, which begins tomorrow with Sounds Green, Bella Tromba, at the Cambridge University Botanic Garden. And here we are, Evening Under Lamplight, Series 3. Series 1 was with 209 Radio quite a while ago. Series 2 was here at Cambridge 105, which ended at the end of 2012. And a year and a half later, it's coming back again as a third series. That makes it sound very pretentious, third series. Why do we say Evening Under Lamplight? Let's spend a minute talking about this name. When I first began the show, I thought and thought and looked around and tried to find the best kind of the title for the show. And quite by accident, I think, I found this line from T.S. Eliot from his Four Quartets. I'll just read you a few lines from the poem. He speaks about there being a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Right, what's he talking about? Partly he's talking about there is a time, reminds us of that line, to everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. So there's a time for Evening Under Lamplight, which of course is 11 o'clock on alternate Tuesdays here on Cambridge 105. So there's a time for sitting out under the starlight. It's nighttime, you're sitting outside, the stars are overhead, it's very peaceful. Maybe there's a view across the valley, I don't know. There's also a time for sitting inside, under lamplight. Then we sit, looking at the photograph album. In the days before television or video, what else could you do but sit and read or look at the photograph album? Here we are sitting under lamplight looking at the photograph album. Let's look at these pictures. Are we sitting alone or with someone else looking over the photograph album? Well, let's ask this way. When it comes to radio, are we sitting alone or with someone else? Exactly. That's the problem. In any case, whether we're sitting under the stars, lost in wonder, or sitting by the lamplight, looking at photographs from the past, as T.S. Eliot says, here and now cease to matter. We're abstracted from the concerns of everyday life. Here we are. You don't worry about what's going on around you. You're just involved with the radio, with Evening Under Lamplight. I'm just involved with this. And T.S. Eliot says, love can be most nearly itself at these moments without these extraneous worries. And that's what I dare to propose here. We, you and I, sit together, separate in our different places, indoors under lamplight, looking at an assortment of pictures in a photo album. This is very innovative radio because we're going to be looking at photo albums on the radio. We'll see if that's a nice image and whether it works. If not, we'll change it. For the moment, the show is organized around a series of photo albums. Of course, you're allowed to listen during the day or out under starlight. During the day, the sun is also a lamp, and the stars at night are lamps, after all. And I want to have the feel of Evening Under Lamplight. Reminds me of this psalm, Psalm 119. I'll give you a bit of Latin. We know we do a bit of Latin on this show. Lucerna pedibus meis. The word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I hope these words will lighten your path And I hope when you get up and move around, your path will be a little bit more enlightened. Mine might be as well, and we can be enlightened together. That would be a lot of fun. So this is Series 3, and there's been a few changes in our way of doing the program. You may recall that last time in Series 2, we played a lot of music. We invited you to attend to the different songs, and we talked about them in various ways. There won't be so much music this time. There'll be no Dylan and Kinks. I used to play one of them on each show. We might bring them back, but probably not. Because if this is going to go out on iTunes podcast, which I think it will, we can't do music. Or if we do, maybe I'll edit it out. You and I live can have music. On the podcast, they can't. There'll be no compulsory reading of Stevenson, which I used to impose upon myself. And there is no script. I used to write the script and just read the script for the previous series. But thanks mainly to AB, who's instructed me that it's much more engaging just for to have me speak. I'm going off script with just a few notes in front of me. Here, listen. You see, that's the paper. I've got some notes on them. And that proves that it's live and you can hear me stumbling. That's supposed to be a little endearing. You know, if I stumble, it makes me human and you like the show better, right? Through our failings comes our strength. Now, speaking of no scripts, I want to open up our first photo album, which is a photo album called Greek Myths. We'll be talking about a lot of Greek myths in this show. That's one of my subjects, and I ask you to join me in looking into it. Uh-oh, I also have to start with this little photo album, a little tag, in Latin, and you'll see where I get myself with this. Ready? Here's some Latin. This is cool. No other radio station in Cambridge will give you Latin through... This is our second Latin passage. I think it's our last one, too. I'm not sure. Et ignotas animum dimittit in artes. That is, he turned his mind into new arts and new crafts. And it's a story about Daedalus. Daedalus, who created the labyrinth, and then in the story, he is stuck in Crete and he wants to get away. The sea and the land are blocked to him. They won't let him go. And for me too, in some ways, the sea and the land is blocked. I'm about to leave a job I've had for nearly 30 years. Where I go next, I don't know. It seems a bit blocked. So Daedalus says, let me take to the air. And here I am, literally, taking to the air and the airwaves. Daedalus took the feathers that landed from the birds flying all around, and he made wings to fly away with. Now I'm going to take feathers, whatever lands from out of the blue, and then we'll see if we can fly off with them, you and me. Okay, but we want to be like Daedalus, who was associated with the labyrinth, that is, to amaze people through the maze. I may get myself a little confused, but I hope I have the key to get out of the labyrinth. I don't want to be like Icarus, his son, who flew along and was too ambitious and flew too close to the sun, and the wax on the wings melted and he plummeted into the sea and was killed. How does that apply? I don't want to fly too high, which means I think I don't want to get lost in the pedantry that I could easily get lost in, like giving you all this Latin stuff. So I will clear out of this subject and turn, I think, to the next photo album, which I think we'll call Playing with Words. Occasionally, I will come up with some words that I have discovered that were new to me and might be new to you, and we'll see where they take us. This is just a little short episode here. And the word is precision. P-R-E-C-I-S-I-A-N. It's a kind of person. A person is a precision. Now, I said I wasn't going to read obligatory Stevenson, but this is a word I came across in a story by Stevenson. He talks about a man who says that he was no precision, but in his wildest times he had never been such a blade, meaning a wild guy, but he's also not a precision. And what's a precision? I had the guts to look this up. Sometimes English professors pretend like they know all words, and I don't go that far. A precision is a person who is strict in religious observance, especially a Puritan. Now, that's in the religious context. I think we can stretch it. A precisian is someone who is precise in doing whatever job, in following all the rules. We call that a job's worth. It's all my job's worth to let you break the rules or stretch the rules. I'm dealing with one of these precisians at the moment who does not allow me to bring my dog into class. For years and years and years, the dog's come into class, and this person saw the dog. She said, "Is there anything in the regulations that allows that dog to come into this building?" And she looked it up. I don't know how much time she spent trying to find out any regulations that would prove her point. All she wanted to do was to keep the dog out of her building and forbade my dog to come to the classroom, which is a little bit of a impoverishment of the class. It's always been nice to have a dog come into the room. That's her problem. I'll deal with it. But she was a precisian. Here's another story about the dog in the classroom. I was teaching at a place where the classroom was far away from the usual haunts. It wasn't in our university building. We had no control of it. And so I asked whether it would be all right to bring the dog into the classroom. "Oh, you better talk to so-and-so who's in charge of the building." So I sent her an email and I asked her. I got no reply, no reply. And finally, 3-4 days into the term, she showed up in the class. And she said, "Do you want to bring your dog into the classroom?" I said, "Well, that'd be nice." She said, "Is it a physical or psychological necessity to have the dog in the class?" Now, I didn't know whether she meant physical and psychological for the dog or for me. The students all said, "Say yes, it is. Yes, it is. Say yes, it is." And I said, "No, it's not a physical or psychological necessity to have the dog in the class." And I turned to everybody and I said, this, I'm bragging about a cool line I once said. I turned to everybody and I said, "I'll save my lie for a better opportunity." I could have lied. But if the dog then, you know, peed on the floor or something, then I'd be in real trouble. Let me wait till another time and build up my credit and tell a lie later on. So that was what I did. I was no precisian. I was no liar either, which is a shame. You always want to be a liar because then we're in the Hermes field. But I told the truth. Now it's time for a station identification. This is what they're technically called. It's a little early, but I wanted to get this in before I forgot. This is Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. And that was going out for Tim, Greg, Julian, and Matt, who weren't sure I would get it all right, but I did, I think. Oh, look, another photo album. Now, this is a photo album that I'm calling Everything That Rises Must Converge. Everything That Rises Must Converge. That's an expression that's based upon the philosophy of a Frenchman called Teilhard de Chardin. And it's this idea that the higher you rise, he's, I think, talking about spiritual rising. He was an anthropologist, and so there may be more to this idea than that. The higher you rise, the more you come together with everybody else who is rising. Now, the image is from lines of longitude on a globe, and the higher you get up towards Canada and the Arctic and so on, the closer the lines come together. So I don't know what the North Pole is in this imagery, but there we are. We all come together to one point. This means, for instance, if you are a Jewish mystic, a Catholic mystic, a Sufi, a Buddhist, a Hindu, the higher you get in any spiritual tradition, the closer you get to other people. So when you find people with their sort of religious and ideological arguments, you know that they're pretty low down on the spiritual scale. If they were higher, they'd be closer together and reaching out to each other. Why is this photo album called that? Well, I think I'll be talking about various traditions that come together and talking about the same sort of thing, about unity, about transformation, about moving beyond the ego. So that's another subject that we're going to be covering here, I think. Now, Everything That Rises Must Converge is also the name of a story by one of my great favorites, Flannery O'Connor. She was a writer from Georgia, very funny, very sharp, very scandalous. And someday I'll tell you about the story about Everything That Rises Must Converge. It's a funny story, it's a sad story, It's a shocking gothic story, but I won't go into it right now, except to use that as a title for this photo album. Now, what I want to do tonight in this photo album is to recommend to you another podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I hope you are listening to this as a podcast and enjoy the pleasures of podcasting. I have a lot of podcasts that come into my iTunes every week, and a lot of the times I listen to them in that in-between period of the morning between coming into vague consciousness and opening my eyes. Now, there I am floating in this in-between state, sometimes drifting away, sometimes not, and coming back and letting these podcasts creep in on me. One in particular that I always like, is, I discovered this not that long ago, called Mind Rolling Podcast. You can find this at mindrollingpodcast.com. Now, this is an interesting podcast. It comes out every week. There are two people who present it, Raghu Marcus and David Silver. They're both in America, but Raghu is Canadian and David is English. They've both been living in the United States for a long time. These are two alterkakers kibitzing on air. What's an alterkaka? It's sometimes called an AK. It means an old shit. Okay. And it's a kindly term. But these are two guys who sit together and they talk about any number of things. They both have an impressive history in the production side of music. On radio and filmmaking, they've had record companies, they've done a lot with world music. They often talk on the podcast about their days with musicians. Some of them you'll have heard of, big stars, and some you won't have heard of. But after they talk and play some of the music, which they do, you want to go out and hear more of it. So it's a good sight to hear pieces that you wouldn't have come across in other ways, and to hear the stories behind them and the personalities behind them. And actually, Raghu and David are some of the personalities behind these pieces. Now, one of the musicians that they often play is Krishna Das, known as the Kirtanwala, Kirtan being Hindu sacred chant. He gives a mesmerizing, haunting, pure, and also westernized versions of these Hindu chants. He's a friend of theirs, actually. He's one of those people who famously went to India with Ram Dass in 1970. I'll talk more about Ram Dass another time. This whole group of people went to India. They sat with Neem Karoli Baba, known as Maharaji, a beautiful guru who's been made known to us through Ram Dass, Krishna Das, and others, including Raghu and David. Now, one of the things that Mind Rolling Podcast does is offer interviews with a whole range of people who are big names in the American Hindu tradition or Buddhist tradition or lots of other traditions or music world. One of the things they ask everybody they interview is how they first turn to the spiritual path. And part of the aim of this podcast is to offer advice and direction from the alterkakas to help the younger people today in today's world about how they could find themselves while they're lost on the path. And Raghu actually always probes to see what role psychedelics played in their transformation. I don't know, you might find that interesting, you might not, but it's not only of current interest, but we end up getting some historical interest from this as well. It's almost like reading memoirs from previous generation. And those of you who belong to that generation will find that, well, memorable, let's say that. They have reflections on articles and events going on. Raghu often finds something from the New York Times and they spend time talking about that. These are profound and compassionate comments, but if I said that, that would embarrass them. And so I'll add that one or the other always undercuts with some kind of horseplay. So it's deep and funny, ironic and cutting and spiritual and a whole range of feelings. So there's my promotion of mindrollingpodcast.com. And one last thing. Let me read you the blurb for their latest podcast. Potent, beautiful perspectives brought about by shattering epiphanies. You see what I mean about sort of self-mocking profundity. Brought about by shattering epiphanies out of the blue. Raghu and David get into this with chat ranging from the edge of awakening caused by everything from a heart attack to a post-concussion Jersey cow. And what is the real difference between acquisitive quid pro quo love and pure unconditional love? Does that grab you? If it does, look for mindrollingpodcast.com. And if you write to them and they will answer you, tell them that RLA sent you. I get no kickbacks. Unconditional love, remember? Hey, are you allowed to smoke under lamplight here? Do you want to smoke? We should have cigars or something like that, I suppose. Maybe a hookah. We could have our little hoses. There must be a different word than hose coming out from the hookah as we sit and look at these photo albums together. The next photo album is called Song of Myself. Now, that should ring a bell. That's the name of a long poem by Walt Whitman, or as we say in Philadelphia, because he's sort of a Philadelphia poet, we call him Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman. The problem is that if I start talking like a Philadelphian, then I really just can't stop myself talking like that. And this is the way, like, I grew up talking. And I really don't think you ought to hear me talk like that too often, because, like, I've sort of covered it over the rest of my life. But it's there, and that's my Philadelphia accent. So Walt Whitman is our next photo album, okay? It's an amazing poem, The Song of Myself. And here, we're going to look tonight, and I hope we will enjoy this. We will look tonight under lamplight at the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. 5 lines. And I'm about to do a bit of my magic. We'll take the 5 lines, and I will see if I can open them up for you and make them come alive and help you, like me, join in the magic of Walt Whitman's world. I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. Okay? You haven't got it. You just heard it once. We'll go through it slowly, line by line, and open up all sorts of things. We'll pretend we're sitting side by side looking at the photograph album. Here it goes. I celebrate myself. Uh-oh. That's very egotistic, isn't it? I celebrate myself. This is my subject. Me, 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 me. James Thompson, who was a Scottish poet, says he sings himself with long unequaled arrogance. But he didn't mean it as a bad thing. He says Whitman himself as average man, claiming nothing personally which shall not be conceded to every human being. So what he says for himself applies to everyone. Van Wyck Brooks, who was an American critic, connected this egotism to Montaigne, who was a famous French writer. Montaigne, who famously wrote all about himself in all sorts of details, like what he ate, what he got rid of from eating, the kind of perfume he likes. Montaigne wrote, I look within myself, and I am only concerned with myself. I reflect on myself. I examine myself. I take pleasure in myself. But wait, wait. It is only egotistic if I celebrate myself to the exclusion of everyone else. I can look at myself and not be egotistic, because look what Whitman says next. What I assume, you shall assume. He's immediately aware, not just of himself, but of us. And it occurs to me how many poets actually directly address us. That's hard to think, but Whitman does address us. What I assume, you shall assume. He shares with us. But what is he sharing? What is he assuming? When we assume, we put on, or we take up something. So he's saying, whatever topics I take up in the poem, you too will take up if you read attentively. Whatever identities I put on, you will too if you read sympathetically. Whatever ideas I assume here, you too shall assume, or at least play with, to see how they may fit you. He takes something up, we take the same thing up, and see how it may work for us. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. We're the same. Whitman goes right to the essentials, to the level where we are all the same, the basic humanity that we all share. But it's a paradox, because Whitman may celebrate what we are all alike, but he is also celebrating the way every single person is different. We're each the same, yet each uniquely different. Can you handle that? This is the wild individuality of each person, each thing. And that's what makes the world so exciting, and yet we all are connected to each other. Every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. He stops. There's a bit of white space. Then he says, as though taking another breath, I loaf and invite my soul. What does it mean to loaf? That's how Whitman is celebrating things. He's loafing. He's stepping out of the bustle of life. He's not idle. His soul is right there. He's observing, reaching out, loving, in fact. And if every atom of this is as good belongs to us, then we'd better loaf and invite our souls, too, into this experience of reading Whitman. What does that mean? I lean and loaf at my ease, he says, observing a spear of summer grass. That's one of Whitman's techniques. He uses repetition, and he builds up, and he builds up. And here he says, I loaf. No, wait. I lean and loaf. I lean and loaf. The picture of Whitman on the cover or the frontispiece of The Leaves of Grass showed him. Wait a minute, I've got it right here. Do you see? Look, there he is in black and white, or sepia, with his hat tilted on the side, one hand, his left hand in his pocket, his right hand bent, the arm bent, and his hand resting on his shoulder, on his waist. He's got an open shirt collar. He's looked like some sort of working man, completely at his ease. Just open to us. And as he says, he's at his ease, at my ease. The cool pose of the outsider, unruffled, open to anything. If you're not at your ease, you're not open to what's going on. He's even open to a spear of summer grass. Now, some people contrast that spear of summer grass to, like, you know, the epic poets who describe their heroes as having sharp-pointed spears with which to throw and kill the enemy. But not Whitman. He'll just take some summer grass. Even in that something as small as that, he can find innumerable things to observe and learn from. Here's what one early biographer said about this, and this was a biography that Whitman helped write and approved of. He says this, like the grass, while old as creation, this book is modern, fresh, universal, spontaneous, not following forms, taking its own form, perfectly free and unconstrained, common as the commonest things, yet its meaning inexhaustible by the greatest intellect, full of life itself, and capable of entering into and nourishing other lives, growing in the sunshine. Perfectly open and simple, yet having meanings underneath, always young, pure, delicate, and beautiful to those who have hearts and eyes to feel and see, but coarse and insignificant and worthless to those who live more in the artificial than in the natural. So there we are. We have to repeat the poem, or at least the lines we're looking at, just to celebrate them for ourselves. I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. That was a little break. Something called Grass Flute. I don't know who performed it, who wrote it. It's from a CD I have called Restful Music of Japan, and I'm afraid that all the credits are in Japanese, and that's beyond me to understand that. What I want to do next is open another photo album, and it is called something that you may remember from the earlier series. It's called Journey Through the Seasons. It's a CD that I produced and wrote and performed a number of years ago, and we go through the seasons meditating on the symbolic meanings of the different seasons and what they might mean in our lives, and also my attempts to bring poetic traditions to bear upon this. And because it is almost midsummer, we've just passed midsummer by, what, a week or so, it's appropriate that we should look at the summer meditation from the album Journey Through the Seasons. You may want to pay attention to what images arise for you as this voice, it's me again, but it's recorded, speaks to you, and these poems that come to you. And you can always write to me either at the station here with Under Evening Under Lamplight at cambridge105.fm, or at my website, which is Moments of, you could write to me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com, and see what you think. Here's the meditation on summer.
Summer. Now comes summer, the yang season of male energy, hot, piercing, active. We are in the intensity of the element of fire, the color red, the heart. This energy extends to all things, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. The danger here, the negative emotion, comes from the misuse of the male energy in violence, arrogance, hastiness, cruelty. We can counter this with the positive emotions of delight, joy, love, creativity. In spring, we discovered our new identity. In summer, we delight in manifesting and exercising this new identity, now mature and radiating out from ourselves and making itself known through desire. What is it men in women do require? The lineaments of gratified desire. What is it women do in men require? The lineaments of gratified desire. Summer fire burns us to cleanse us. A terrifying but essential experience. There may be pain here, but no death. When we remember this, we see that the flame is, in fact, a tender flame. O living flame of love that tenderly wounds my soul in its deepest center. This fire of love rescues us from that other fire, the hellish fire of a life cut off from the sacred. Both can burn us, but one destroys while the other heals. The only hope, or else despair, lies in the choice of pyre or pyre, to be redeemed from fire by fire. This summer energy can overwhelm us. This is not the watery drowning of the winter when we cannot grasp what is going on. The fire shows us all too clearly what is going on. We see good and bad at once, and we know both belong to love. Here is my dilemma. Please help me understand. Your love is a healer. Your love is a wise master. Your love is radiant. Your love is delicate and is soft in its essence. I would gladly endure all this fire, all this yearning, all this burning for your love. But if your love is so pleasant, why does it hurt so much? Love hurts because we are vulnerable. The fire offers light and heat to others. So does love, even to the emptying of itself. Love came and became like blood in my body. It rushed through my veins and encircled my heart. Everywhere I looked, I saw one thing: the beloved's name written on my limbs, on my left palm, on my forehead, on the back of my neck, on my right big toe. Oh, my friend, all that you see of me is just a shell, and the rest belongs to the beloved. Here is the generous, joyous energy of summer.
And there was the meditation on summer. That music, by the way, that you heard in the background was written by Neil Henry, who graciously allows me the copyright to play this anytime I want. Speaking of Neil Henry, let me give a little plug. Neil Henry is doing a one-man show at the Edinburgh Fringe. It's called Neil Henry's Impossible. Does that mean the impossible of Neil Henry or Neil Henry is impossible? It's called ambiguity. It means, of course, both. This is at the Fringe, at the Pleasance Theatre. I think it's venue 33. It's a really good room, and it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon every day, and it comes under the heading of both comedy and magic. So he'll be doing magic, and he's a great performer, and it's always interesting. So go see that when you go to you are going to Edinburgh for the festival, aren't you? Even just a few days. It's always worth going to Edinburgh for the festival. Shall we look at what's coming up at the Edinburgh Festival and the Fringe and give you a few previews on the show? That's an idea. You let me know what's interesting and I'll see what I can do to accommodate you. But now I've got another photo album. This may be the last one we have time to look at. Oh, no, wait a minute. It's the same photo album we looked at before. This is the Everything That Rises Must Converge album. And I've got a book here, and I'm going to read you some stories from this book. This book is called The Exploits of the Incomparable Mullah Nasruddin. Have you heard of Nasruddin? Nasruddin is this amazing Turkish legendary 13th century judge. Religious leader. He was a fool. He's a wise guy. He's a shlemiel. He features in all these stories. Some of them, I suppose, are based upon the truth. Some of them are legends, and some of them are just stories that people have had, and they just throw it into the Nasruddin pot and make him the main character in the stories. Here's one of the stories. They're sort of funny stories, short little things. Most of them are only less than one page. Not that it matters to you, you're not looking at the page. I am. See what you think. This first one is called Why We Are Here. Walking one evening along a deserted road, Mullah Nasruddin saw a troop of horsemen coming towards him. His imagination started to work. He saw himself captured and sold as a slave or impressed into the army. Nasruddin bolted, climbed a wall into a graveyard, and lay down in an open tomb. Puzzled at his strange behavior, the men, honest travelers, followed him. They found him stretched out, tense and quivering. "What are you doing in that grave? We saw you run away. Can we help you?" "Just because you can ask a question does not mean that there is a straightforward answer to it," cried the mullah, who now realized what had happened. "It all depends upon your viewpoint. If you must know, however, I am here because of you, and you are here because of me." Pithy little statement. Here's another little story. It's called, and this is a title given to it by Idris Shah, who collected these stories here. Idris Shah was a well-known Sufi who lived in England and brought a lot of these stories to the English consciousness in the later part of the 20th century. Nasruddin sometimes took people for trips in his boat. One day, a fussy pedagogue, that is like a teacher, hired him to ferry him across a very wide river. As soon as they were afloat, the scholar asked whether it was going to be a rough crossing. "Don't ask me nothing about it," said Nasruddin. "Have you never studied grammar?" "No," said Nasruddin. "In that case, half your life has been wasted." The mullah said nothing. Soon a terrible storm blew up. The mullah's crazy little boat was filling with water. He leaned over towards his companion. "Have you ever learned to swim?" "No," said the pedant. "In that case, Mr. Schoolmaster, all your life is lost, for we are sinking." There we are. Teaches me to start correcting other people's grammar too, doesn't it? But I do know how to swim, I suppose. Here's a story. You've heard this before. I remember hearing this about elephants or something when I was a little boy. And maybe this is where the story begins. This is just a four-line story. Nasruddin was throwing handfuls of crumbs around his house. "What are you doing?" someone asked him. "Well, I'm keeping the tigers away." "But there are no tigers in these parts." "That's right. Effective, isn't it?" Ta-dam. But this is the last story, and I find it very significant, and I'll explain why in a minute. One day, Nasruddin lent his cooking pots to a neighbor who was giving a feast. The neighbor returned them together with one extra pot, a very tiny pot. "What's this?" asked Nasruddin. "According to the law, I have given you the offspring of your property, which was born when the pots were in my care," said the joker. Shortly afterwards, Nasruddin borrowed his neighbor's pots, but did not return them. The man came around to get them back. "Alas," said Nasruddin, "they are dead. We have established, have we not, that pots are mortal?" Interesting. What I find interesting is that this is the same story that is elaborated in the Jewish story, the Yiddish story, about Yekel and the silver spoons. And I'll tell it to you very briefly. Once upon a time, there was Yekel who was lived by his wits. They had no money. His wife said, "You better get me some money." He said, "What have we got to invest in this scheme?" She said, "All we have are three silver spoons." "Okay," he said, "I'll take care of it." He went over to the rich man, Reb Nachman, the rich man in the village, and he said, "Reb Nachman, you know I don't make a very good living, but I want to tell you I've got a good business deal coming up. I'm inviting the businessmen to my house for a nice dinner, but the problem is I only have two silver soup spoons, and I need a third for my guests. I don't want them to think that I'm a poor man. So I wondered, could I borrow one of your silver soup spoons?" And Reb Nachman says, "I don't trust you at all, Yankel." And he said, "I promise you I will bring it back tomorrow." So Reb Nachman lends him the spoon. He takes it back to his house. The next day he gives it back to Reb Nachman, but he gives him also a little silver teaspoon. He says, "Interesting news, Reb Nachman. When your spoon was at my house, it had a baby. Here's the baby. It's your spoon. I'll give you the baby too." Well, Reb Nachman was intrigued. And the next week, Yanko went along and he said, "I'm having this man again. I wonder, could I just borrow your spoon just one more time? And, you know, if this deal comes across, I'll be doing okay." Reb Nachman figures this is a pretty good deal, and he gives him the spoon. And the same thing happens this time as happened last week. And Yanko returns with the silver soup spoon and a little silver teaspoon. "The soup spoon had a baby," he says. This happens a third time. It had a baby. Now, fourth time, Yekel shows up at Reb Nachman's door and he says, "I'll tell you what, the deal's through, it's finished, I'm going to be a rich man, we're having a big dinner, and I'd like to celebrate with, listen, I know you've got this beautiful silver soup tureen, I know it's your pride and joy, but can I borrow it just for one night when I have people around to celebrate this big business deal?" Well, Reb Nachman says, "You can have my special soup tureen, this big, heavy, silver item. But, you know, if it has, you know, like a baby or something, you know, it comes back to me." And Yankel said, "I know the deal. Here we go. I will borrow your soup tureen, and I promise I'll bring it back tomorrow." The next day, Reb Nachman is waiting and waiting and waiting for his soup tureen to come back. And Yankel shows up at the door, and he says, "Where's the soup tureen?" He says, Oi, Reb Nachman, have I got news for you? Last night, that soup tureen, remember the soup tureen? Yes, I remember the soup tureen. Where is it? He says, I've got news for you. The soup tureen died. What? It died. The soup tureen died. I had to bury it. Where is it? I said, it's buried. I can't give it to you. Oh, that's nonsense. He says, Yaakov, you come with me. They go to the rabbi. And they say to the rabbi, Reb Nachman explains everything to the rabbi, and he says, it's obvious that Yekel is making this all up. He's got the soup tureen, he's going to sell it, and he's going to make a profit off of my piece of property. Listen, rabbi, I want you to tell Yekel to give back the soup tureen. The rabbi says, Reb Nachman, give up all hope of ever seeing that soup tureen again. If a spoon can have a baby, a soup tureen can die. I don't know if that worked, that little bit of klezmer music. That was the Abe Edelstein Orchestra with the Goldene Chazana, a little klezmer music at the end of this little Jewish story. Everything that rises must converge. We've got a Sufi Islamic story and a Jewish story, and they come together, and may they all come together, and may we all come together again in 2 weeks' time with Evening Under Lamplight. Next week, at the same time, we'll find Patrick Wittes with Headstand here at the same spot. So you come along and listen to Patrick Wittes next week. The week after that, you can come and listen to Evening Under Lamplight, the next show in Series 3. And so this is Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, wishing you a good night from Evening Under Lamplight.